Today is Thursday, July 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as the U.S. edges closer to a trade war, who stands to lose the most? A British couple is hospitalized after apparently being poisoned by the same nerve agent that afflicted a Russian spy and his daughter.
Our priorities at this time are to care for the patients and to understand the circumstances surrounding how these two individuals became unwell.
Also ahead, a female rapper that is topping the charts. It's all on today's International Edition. Chinese counter-tariffs of $34 billion are expected to immediately follow scheduled U.S. tariffs of an equal amount of Chinese imports Friday over forced technology transfers and limited market access for U.S. companies. That, according to Beijing, charges that Beijing denies. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has given Chinese telecom ZTE Corporation a small reprieve from a supplier ban to conduct business to maintain existing networks and equipment while moving to block China Mobile from offering its services to the U.S. market. Grant Newsham is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He was asked by International Edition's Victor Beatty who stands to lose the most in a trade war.
China, ultimately. The United States economy really is better able to absorb anything the Chinese might do. And the Chinese really are talking a good game. You know, it's not in their interests domestically to appear weak or even frightened of the United States. But anything that threatens to really cut off the foreign exchange, foreign currency inflow into the Chinese economy is something that has the Chinese Communist Party immensely worried.
In a related story, there are two Chinese telecom companies involved in some controversy with the U.S. The U.S. Commerce Department Tuesday has granted a temporary, reportedly one-month reprieve to ZTE Corporation, allowing the number two telecom equipment maker to conduct business needed to maintain existing networks and equipment. At the same time, the U.S. government has moved to block China Mobile from offering services to the country's telecommunications market. What do you make of those two developments?
The ZTE treatment really is perplexing. It is possible the Trump administration has a very clever sort of chess game in mind that somehow is going to lead to great results. But I consider it a big mistake on the administration's part. By closing down ZTE, it had really had a very powerful effect on China's leadership. And this was really a taste of what else was possible. And as I noted, that the Chinese cannot withstand for very long the cut of the foreign exchange, which they earn from companies like ZTE. Plus, it's immensely embarrassing to both China and ZTE in particular and other companies where they're treated as scofflaws, sort of companies that don't obey the law, and also espionage platforms, which raises doubts with many of their other customers too. So really, the Trump administration should have just closed it down, finished off the company, and then said, now let's talk. But by keeping it on life support system, I think they've really dissipated or weakened, diluted the benefits that they otherwise would have gotten from it. So the Chinese may be confused by what the Americans are doing, but ultimately they're probably thinking, well, no matter what we do, the Americans will always concede or sort of give us a way out. As for the China Mobile, the U.S. government is rightly concerned about the security and espionage applications to which Chinese mobile hardware and systems can be put. This really has been obvious for a long time that the Chinese do use these telecommunications companies for this kind of activity. Huawei, another Chinese company, is even worse, if anything. So from a national security perspective, this is simply common sense by the Trump administration. Business-wise, probably won't have much effect on China Mobile given the sort of the global scope of its operations. But once again, this also embarrasses the PRC. No doubt they're probably pretty surprised that the Americans are actually pushing back for once against the things that they've been doing. If one compares or considers the China Mobile decision and the ZTE decision, they're a little bit contrary. So that probably confuses some Americans just as much as it does some Chinese.
That's Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. China issues a U.S. travel warning as trade tensions escalate. Thousands of Rohingya continue to flee violence in Myanmar. A U.S. drone kills an Afghan-based Pakistani Taliban commander. And the U.S. offers German automakers a solution to the trade spat. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. For the second time in 4 months, two people lie critically ill in England's Salisbury District Hospital after being exposed to a military-grade nerve agent developed in the Soviet Union. The country's chief counterterrorism police officer said tests at Britain's defense laboratory had confirmed what many residents feared. A man and woman in their 40s had been poisoned with the same toxin that almost killed a former Russian spy and his daughter. Chief Medical Officer for England, Dame Sally Nate Davies.
Following events in March, we have a well-established response to this type of incident and clear processes to follow. Our priorities at this time are to care for the patients and to understand the circumstances surrounding how these two individuals became unwell, thus ensuring there is no further risk to the public's health from this incident.
Local police declared the case a major incident Wednesday, 4 days after the man and woman were found collapsed at a residential building in Amesbury, 13 kilometers from Salisbury, where the Skripals were poisoned. Deputy Chief Constable Paul Mills says the investigation is just getting started.
Our inquiries, supported by local partner agencies and the counter-terrorism policing network, are ongoing, and a full multi-agency response has been coordinated, which currently consists of 12 partner agencies.
It's not clear whether there was a link between the two cases and whether the nerve agent came from the same batch that left the Skripals fighting for their lives. Britain accuses Russia of attacking them. Russia denies it. A protester climbed the Statue of Liberty's base on Wednesday and was eventually escorted down by police after a roughly four-hour standoff that forced the evacuation of Liberty Island on the 4th of July. After two New York Police Department officers went up to the base and reached her, they moved carefully along the edge of the statue's robes toward a ladder. Earlier, several people on the statue's pedestal hung a banner emblazoned with a message against immigration and customs enforcement, and they were arrested. Meanwhile, volunteer lawyers say parents are distressed about losing their children and having no firm date for when they'll be reunited. After President Donald Trump ordered an end to the separations on June 20th, border authorities generally stopped splitting up families for prosecution, but many are still separated. A federal judge in San Diego ruled last week that families must be reunited in 30 days or 14 days if the children are younger than five. Joining us now is Save the Children Chief Operating Officer Carlos Carazana. What is your organization's position on all this?
For us, main focus is reunification of the more than 2,300 children who have been separated from their parents, and we still have want to make a stand against the administration. We are aware that I think there's progress now with the judge ending family separation, but Lori, as you can imagine, it's chaos, and there are so many unanswered questions. So we still want to make sure that the administration basically puts the children first, which is not what's happening.
I know there has been a deadline set for that, but it sounds like there could be some issues as far as not uncertainty as to where the families and children are as far as maybe not keeping records. Have you heard anything about that?
We are following this very closely, and like I said, there are so many unanswered questions and contradictions out there. We are trying to motivate and mobilize all of our advocates around the country, and we've been able to generate more than 65,000 messages to Congress about keeping families together. Our job now is to really stand against the administration and make sure they put the children first.
Do you have any idea of a plan or some sort of strategy in place? Or do you have any, is your organization working to try to assist in that?
At the moment, our main goal is really to advocate, but we are starting to look into ways to actually help with partners on the ground, but we are still in the process of figuring that out. We are getting prepared at Save the Children to support this effort for the long run. We do not think that just because we've seen some progress, progress, that this is the end of this. This is just the beginning. The coordination, from what we understand, coordination between Homeland Security and Department of Health and Human Services, it's very weak. So we think this is going to be quite chaotic for quite a while.
What happens if they are unable to figure out where families are in relation to their children? What happens to the kids?
Right. That's what's really heart-wrenching and alarming. What is going to happen to these kids?
Is your organization planning to attempt to visit any of these detention centers where these kids are?
We are in the process to think through that. We actually work in Central America and those countries, Honduras, Guatemala, Salvador, and Mexico. So we are trying to address the core issue of the crisis in those countries. And then here in the U.S., we did respond years ago on the border crisis, so we are thinking through this, Lori, on how we can move from the advocacy to the programmatic perspective.
All right, that's Save the Children Chief Operating Officer Carlos Carazana. Thanks for being with us. Crews are making progress against a Northern California wildfire that threatens hundreds of buildings, but fire officials say wind and dry vegetation could still fuel the blaze. California officials said the fire in rural counties northwest of Sacramento was 25% contained as of Wednesday morning, and that's up from 5% the previous day. It has burned through 334 square kilometers after igniting on Saturday. Some areas have been under evacuation orders for days. It's among the massive wildfires burning in the western United States that put some 4th of July plans on hold. Joining us now for more on what's happening in the western U.S. is CAL FIRE spokesperson Lynn Tolmachoff. Lynn, what can you tell us about what's happening?
Currently, there's a few fires. We had some new ones start just today. But previous to today, there was probably about four larger wildfires still burning in the state, with the county fire being the largest of all.
And how is containment going for that one?
They have definitely been making some progress. They're at about just over 82,000 acres, but they are 25% contained as of right now. So things are going well. They're gaining some ground on it, but they still have a long ways to go.
Any structures in danger or homes?
There are homes that are threatened, so they do have some evacuation orders in place. Fortunately, though, the good news is we have no structures that have been damaged or destroyed from this fire.
Now, this is just the beginning of the fire season out there, right?
Generally, yes. Usually we start to get busier usually in July. At least that's what it has been in previous years. But as we know, the climate in California is changing, so we're starting to see these fires starting earlier in the year. So coming into June, we are already starting to see some of the larger, more damaging wildfires. And, of course, right now we're ahead of what you would consider the normal for a five-year average in the state.
So would that sort of indicate that you're probably in for a pretty active wildfire season this year?
It appears to be that way, yes, absolutely. Another trend that we're starting to see is we've had a couple of red flag warnings in Northern California already this year, which is almost unheard of in the month of June. We usually will start seeing that later in the summer here and there, but this early in the year with these kind of winds is a little bit out of the norm. And then also this weekend, we're coming into some weather patterns in Southern California, similar to what we saw in December in the same areas of Ventura and Santa Barbara counties.
So when you say conditions, you mean very hot? I mean, I know it's already the wind and the heat can't be a good combination, and certainly everything's pretty dry, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, California's used to having the higher temperatures. We're used to being in the 90s. That's just kind of the climate it is out here. Unfortunately, we're starting to see the upper 90s as being a normal thing, and then also, you know, peaking into well over 100. Also, combine that with low humidity, when that reaches into the teens or even the single digits, that's very dangerous. And then on top of that, when you get winds, particularly out of the north, they're very dry winds, that's just a combination that is absolutely devastating if a wildfire should start.
So how does the state prepare for the unknown when it comes to wildfires?
You know, that's the thing. It's unknown. You're talking, you know, millions of acres in the state, and you can't predict exactly where that one fire is going to start. So we do our best, obviously, starting off with prevention and education. That's a big thing. We have our fuels crews out there doing clearing, trying to get some buffer zones in different parts of the state that are, you know, at high risk for wildfires. And then, of course, the prevention efforts of teaching the public to be very careful when they're outside and not spark a fire. And then, of course, if it comes down to it, the suppression efforts. We have the very large air tankers in place ready to go. We currently have two DC-10s sitting at McClellan reload base in Sacramento ready to go when the call comes.
Now, I know that California isn't the only Western state that's dealing with wildfires and having concerns for the rest of the wildfire season. Do you all collaborate at all with other states or ever get other states' firefighters' assistance or vice versa?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely do that, as a matter of fact. So we it's kind of a not necessarily a written understanding with all of our Western state partners that we deal with the same sort of effects of climate change and just the weather conditions in the U.S. now, in the western part of the U.S. So definitely, right now, Utah has a very large wildfire burning. If they needed the assistance and we were able to help, we would definitely send them equipment or personnel as needed. And then, of course, the large air tankers and helicopters that we contract with, those are also available to other states if we're not using them. So we definitely try our best to work together and help each other out as best we can.
All right. Cal Fire spokesperson Lynn Tolmachoff, we wish you all the best out there. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. The 4th of July Independence Day holiday holds a special place in the hearts of Americans. All across the country, citizens traditionally gather for picnics and fireworks on the 4th to celebrate the country's birth in 1776 and to reaffirm the vibrancy of U.S. democracy. But in recent years, democracy has increasingly come under strain in a politically polarized country where voices are often raised in anger and common ground is hard to find. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
Nothing brings Americans together like fireworks on the 4th of July. It's a time for the country to catch its collective breath and reflect on the democratic ideals upon which it was founded. Those ideals have turned to action in the streets in recent days, including immigration protests that drew thousands around the country. The upcoming battle to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy also has heightened divisions. Both parties are energized, including Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts.
People are rising up. Donald Trump is not king. No one makes it to the Supreme Court without going through the United States Senate.
Trump supporters have also been vocal of enthusiastically standing with a president who vowed to disrupt Washington and restore America's greatness.
We're bringing back our pride, we're bringing back our jobs, we're bringing back our wealth. And for the citizens of this great land, we're bringing back our beautiful American dreams.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Political differences have sharpened during Trump's presidency, and that includes scrutiny of the ongoing Russia probe led by special counsel Robert Mueller. Polls show most Americans support the investigation, but many Republicans, like Congressman Trey Gowdy, see it as divisive.
Whatever you got, finish it the hell up, because this country is being torn apart.
The political divisions in the country are real, and so at times is the fear, says historian Alan Lichtman.
People feel like they are being written out of America simply because of their political beliefs, their gender, their race, their religion, And really, we haven't had that for quite some time in modern America.
Thank you, South Carolina.
Because of the intense loyalty and opposition that Trump generates, so the president has come to symbolize the widening political divide, says Gallup pollster Frank Newport.
Trump himself is very polarizing. The public is very polarized. They're worried about the government, worried about long-term economic strength with the change with artificial intelligence and everything that's going on. So his great economic success on a relative basis has not been translated into personal approval or overall satisfaction.
For the most part, Americans like to set politics aside on the 4th of July and celebrate democracy. But many worry that the sharp political divisions on display daily make it harder to find common ground in a country where democracy is vibrant, but also under strain. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA says, according to computer models, galaxies are created when dark matter clumps together. In other words, you usually can't find a galaxy without a good amount of dark matter. That is until a recent discovery that has been detailed in the journal Nature. A group of astronomers who used both ground-based telescopes and NASA's Hubble Space Telescope found an odd galaxy out there that they say has very little, if any, dark matter. According to the study, the galaxy called NGC 1052 DF2, which is as big as our Milky Way, only contains about 1/400th the amount of dark matter that was expected. The study's lead author, Peter Van Dokkum of Yale University, says the stars in the galaxy can account for all its mass. There doesn't seem to be any room for dark matter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, a female rapper is getting tremendous success on the music charts. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with details.
Today, Sarah, we're going to take a listen to a brand new song by one of the hottest performers, vocalist, female artist, rappers on the planet. Cardi B is her name, and she's just become the very first female rapper to score two consecutive number one hits. Bodak Yellow was number one for 3 weeks last year in 2017, and now her new single, I Like It, with J Balvin, who's from Colombia, is a number one song. So congratulations to Cardi B. Let's check it out. The song's called I Like It.
I like stunning, I like shining, I like $1 million deals. Where's my pen? I'm signing. I like those Balenciagas, the ones that look like socks. I like going to the Tula, I put rocks all in my watch. I like sexes from my exes.
Okay, well, that's quite an honor for her to have two number one singles. That's
yes,
great.
She's very, very excited. She posted video online of her driving in the car going, oh, Billboard number one again. I love being number one. Her album is called Invasion of Privacy. It's her debut album. When it came out, it also reached number one. So she's achieved something that no one else has achieved as far as female rappers are concerned. And the last time that a female rap artist was number one anyway was, you know, Lauryn Hill and Lil Kim and those artists. They had hit number one, but that was years ago. So she's done something that is groundbreaking, and she's also achieved something that hasn't been done in quite a while. So congratulations to Cardi B. And the last time that an artist had two number ones on their debut album was Macklemore and Ryan. The album was called Heist, and it was 2012. Cardi B is going to be joining Bruno Mars on his 24 Karat Magic Tour in a few weeks. She's expecting a baby any day now. She's made it public that the baby is a little girl. She secretly wed Offset from the group Migos back in September. They had kept it quiet until about a week ago when they finally revealed, yes, we have in fact got married. They're living together, and they have a couple of dogs. In fact, this past week, it was announced by Cardi B that their two dogs, Bougie and Bentley, gave birth to a litter of eight puppies. So they got a lot going on in
their
house.
They're going to have a busy household.
It's a busy, busy household. And speaking of J Balvin, who's from Colombia, he had a hit song last year with Beyonce called Mi Gente, and he's also going out on tour as well. Cardi B's real name is Belcalis Almanzar, and that is an interesting name, but, you know, her sister's name is Hennessy. So she adopted Cardi from Bacardi, and she added the B, which she says stands for beautiful. So Cardi B and J Balvin, and the song's called I Like It. And she's also featured on a new song by Maroon 5 about girls. So she's out there doing a lot of stuff for somebody who's pregnant and supposedly laying low. So wait until the summer, you know, when she goes out on tour with Bruno Mars, and then she gets back in the studio and starts working on new music.
She is a very busy lady.
Very, very busy, and she's got a lot of energy. She's a bubbly person. So I love her music. I love what she does. People have criticized her, you know, for not having the best grammar, for not being the most articulate person. And she says, I am who I am. Take me as I am. And apparently enough people are, because she's number one this week.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
I said I like it like that. I said I like it like that. I'm the district in the chat.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. recognizes the desperate needs of the persecuted religious and ethnic communities of the Middle East and is sending immediate help. The U.S. will not rest until these oppressed people receive the help they need to thrive again, wrote U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Mark Green in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has been tasked with providing more effective and direct support to persecuted religious and ethnic minorities, including Christians and Yazidis. To this end, Administrator Green announced that USAID had redirected more than $60 million in humanitarian and stabilization assistance to provide infrastructure support and life-saving aid in northern Iraq. The money, said Administrator Green, has helped rebuild schools, hospitals, power stations, and wells, and ease the transition of those returning home. However, in too many instances, the aid has taken too long to arrive. Many of the communities with the greatest need have yet to be reached. To overcome bureaucratic and other obstacles, USAID is now redoubling its efforts to distribute the aid Iraq's persecuted religious communities desperately need. Every delay brings these religious communities one day closer to extinction. In Iraq, nearly 90% of Christians have fled in the past 15 years, emptying entire villages that had stood for more than 1,000 years. The Yazidi population has been similarly decimated. The time to act is now, declared Administrator Green. Christians, Yazidis, and other persecuted religious communities in the Middle East have suffered unspeakable harm for too long. Their plight has touched the hearts of the American people and stirred this nation to step up with compassion and conviction. The ancient faith communities in Iraq and across the Middle East are counting on us, said Administrator Green. We will not let them down.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.